All right, the next case is Elliott Bay Adjustment versus Karen DeCumas. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Jason Anderson on behalf of Appellant Karen DeCumas.
How much time would you wish to reserve?
I would like to reserve 4 minutes, please.
Okay. Proceed.
There are really only two facts or points or anything at all that I want to discuss today, which is fact one, which is my client was sued for $482. And fact two was my client obtained a dismissal with prejudice. That's it. That's all this case is about. That's all that happened. So then, at risk of repeating the briefing, the operation of RCW 484-250 means that Ms. DeCumas is entitled to her attorney's
fees. Do you think a dismissal with prejudice is a judgment?
A dismissal with prejudice is a judgment on the merits, Your Honor. That's my understanding from pretty much all of Washington's history, is that a dismissal with prejudice is and has always been the final resolution of the controversy and a termination on the merits.
You think that was that clear to the courts below? Did you talk about that below?
just so I understand Your Honor's question.
If it's so clear, why wasn't the trial court apprised of it and persuaded by it?
Well, I suppose I can't answer why the trial court did what it did or didn't do what it didn't do in this case.
Was authority put in front of the trial court? The cases that are so persuasive in Washington's history?
About a dismissal with... Go ahead, Your Honor.
Yeah, the cases that you're suggesting are so persuasive. Was that briefed to the trial court?
My understanding is yes, Your Honor, although I'm not necessarily sure. I'm probably just not understanding the question fully, because my understanding is a dismissal with prejudice. That's the legal...
Well, here, let me ask it this way. The other party was persuaded by your response to summary judgment and agreed to dismiss the case but wanted it to be without prejudice. And so then you came in and argued to the court it should be a dismissal with prejudice. And the court agreed and wrote with instead of without. But then what is odd, at least in terms of us trying to understand exactly how this all came about, is that the court said... Motion denied, motion for attorney's fees under 484. Order on dismissal does not fulfill the statutory requirement for a judgment. And so where did that come from? It's hard to find that argument being made in any of by either party prior to that. Was new stuff brought up in argument in front of the district court?
Your Honor's guess is as good as mine.
Am I correct that our record does not contain a transcript of the oral proceedings in front of the district court?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no evidence adduced at that particular proceeding. I think I can, actually, with that question, Your Honor, I think I can pinpoint the source of a lot of the confusion that was underlying the trial court's reasoning. I don't know this. Of course, I'm not inside the trial court's mind, but we see in both the Alliance One versus Lewis case and then, to some extent, the Wachovia case, which Alliance One relies on, is there's this shorthand phrasing that's applied to CR 41 dismissals as a voluntary dismissal, mm-hmm. which is not inaccurate, but that shorthand was applied with a... In those cases, it made sense, the reason that that was applied. Both of those cases involved the plaintiff moving to dismiss. The dismissal was granted without prejudice. Nobody disputed that that's what happened. It was a dismissal without prejudice. That's what was entered. And for whatever reason, the Supreme Court used that shorthand phrasing as a manner to explain when someone moves for a CR 41 dismissal and then obtains a dismissal without prejudice, I think the shorthand was used as voluntary dismissal. So I believe the trial court in this case, the language still doesn't make complete sense to me, Your Honor, to be honest, but this is voluntary dismissal does not meet the requirements for judgment.
Intellectual... You have a It's one of the things that's odd is at first you have, on September 14th, you have an order that Elliott Bay submitted. And although the court changed it from without prejudice to with prejudice, the caption still says order for voluntary dismissal. And I guess maybe that leads to, which I guess we'll hear from Elliott Bay, there seems to be some kind of an argument that the district court didn't really intend to enter a final judgment, even though that is the effect of a dismissal with prejudice.
And to that, Your Honor, I would say I'm not aware of any cases that rely on the subjective, unstated intent behind an order. I believe the written order controls always. And the written order says dismissed with prejudice. I think that's pretty clear phrasing. I think that's something that's understood to be a final judgment in any sense of the term. I don't think anyone would disagree that Elliott Bay cannot bring this lawsuit again, no matter how much it would like to or want to or whatever. That's the effect of a dismissal with prejudice, and that's what the trial court ordered, was a dismissal with prejudice. Trial court did not order a dismissal with prejudice, but also something else, or a dismissal kind of with prejudice, or a dismissal unstated, or some other phrasing of it. I don't think that the trial court's subjective intent plays into this at all, and I think that the entire body of Washington law suggests that dismissal with prejudice is the operative document, and that's what terminates the controversy and terminates it on the merits in favor of the party who obtains that. So. I'll reserve my.
All right. You have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Christopher Howard here on behalf of Respondent Elliott Bay Adjustment Company. I know there are a lot of questions about the record. First, let me just make quite clear that we believe this appeal is about the application of Rawls 9.1 and its plain language, much more than the application of 4.84.250. This court has multiple independent grounds to uphold the Superior Court order, including two to which no exception was taken by appellants, that being that there was no evidence to support fees, an issue which was raised below, argued below, submitted in the order, and no exception taken, and that fees would be de minimis on the record before the District and Superior Court. Once again, contained in that order.
What is the case that you think is the best authority that you can think of for why that means that fees would not be awarded?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer the specific question on de minimis fees means no fees.
Yeah, because the idea that a trial court can eyeball a case and say, well, it doesn't look to me like this case really needed to involve a lot of attorney's fees, so I'll just deny them. Well, that would seem to run afoul of the well-established lodestar methodology of deciding attorney's fees.
Your Honor, I disagree to the extent that even lodestar requires the court to enter specific findings on what fees were reasonable and necessary and appropriate for the case. So if in lodestar all the work has gone on unnecessarily because the case could have been avoided with 1 hour of work, lodestar would still support no more than 1 hour of fee. But my point here being there was no exception taken to either of those bases for the appeal. So it hasn't been specifically briefed and presented to you with that authority, Your Honor, because they did not take exception or raise the issue on appeal. And while they might have, and we might now be arguing those specific cases, they did not. Instead, what they said was, what was the trial court doing entering findings? And yet, once again, Rawls 9.1G specifically requires the court to enter the basis for its order.
Written reasons, right?
The written reasons. It is required
that's
to give
the same
the basis.
Thing as findings and conclusions, though, is it?
It's required to give the basis for its opinions. That is not worded in Rawls 9.1 as findings and conclusions, and I have not found a case, Your Honor, that has addressed the language of Rawls 9.1 in that regard. The closest I can find to a case addressing Rawls 9.1 is a recent unreported case that simply addresses the standard on review afterwards, which is the Snyder case. I can submit that if the court's interested, that says this court could also look at the evidence before the district court if it wanted to. But I cannot find a Washington Court of Appeals which has interpreted Rawls 9.1's language on part G. Similarly, B and E, which specifically address, once again basically rejected by appellant in their briefing as, well, they're missing the point of 4.85, but Rawlsh 9.1 B and G expressly empower the Superior Court to modify the ruling of the District Court, and furthermore tell them that in doing so, they should look at not only the factual determinations made, but those that may be reasonably inferred from the record, which this Court is also empowered to do under Rawlsh 9.1 because this appeal is governed by Rawlsh 9.1. And before the Court, there was no submission to prove any attorney's fees. Now, while it's true, appellant may come up and say, well, we were going to submit that later. That was argued before. It was a basis of the opinion below, and no exception taken on appeal.
We can fix that on remand, can't we?
You could submit to a hearing on remand if necessary, but it wasn't
accepted. Because it was a threshold decision that was potentially erroneous. That is, fees are denied. There's no point at that point in doing anything to perfect the record.
I would agree more, Your Honor, if they had taken exception. They took no exception. It is basically, I believe, governed in the case by him not taking exception to that basis for the opinion, and it gives this Court the ability to support it on that.
Are you saying not taking exception in this appeal to this Court?
They did not take exception to this appeal to this Court on the specific finding of the Superior Court that there was no factual support for attorney's fees, which was raised in the briefing both at the District Court level and at the Superior Court level, and basically ignored by appellant at both times and then not accepted to on appeal.
Well, whether or not there was an entitlement to fees in light of the dismissal is a question of law, is it not?
It would be if you accept the mechanistic and, I will say, inappropriate argument made by appellant. They're arguing there's no discretion once there is their interpretation of Lewis versus Alliance One.
We're being asked to interpret the statute.
I would suggest that you're being asked to interpret under 9.1 what the evidence was before the Court, which included a discretionary ruling. Their whole motion for fees is based upon a highly discretionary ruling of whether or not to strike out without prejudice in a matter where most Western Washington case law, Division I case law, specifically says a party has a right to a CR 41 non-suit, generally without prejudice.
Okay, but it's with prejudice here, so it's a judgment on the merits.
Your Honor, what the plaintiff has appealed is effectively the Superior Court reading two orders, which they may contend are in conflict. And your questions were excellent. Was this pointed out to the judge when you asked her with prejudice what the impact would be? And when the judge is given a second ruling, the judge is making clear at the District Court level, I did not intend this to be a finding on the merits. Now, if you look at the language in Alliance One versus Lewis, Alliance One versus Lewis, which admittedly deals with a matter that was a without prejudice dismissal, but it goes through specifically at page 397 the public policy issues behind the attorney's fee statute involved, and it's talking about the need for there to be an actual hearing on the merits, that the plaintiff has an opportunity to dismiss a case that it no longer wants to proceed. And so if you look at the language and the policy set forth by our Supreme Court in Alliance One, this case has been not qualified with a hearing on the merits, no transcript submitted by the plaintiffs in their appeal, although parenthetically, we tried to submit the transcript out.
Okay, we have a dismissal with prejudice. Does that or does that not amount to a judgment on the merits?
Under Alliance One, it would not qualify for a judgment on the merits.
So did Alliance One overrule all those previous cases that are cited that say that a final judgment on the merits is what happens when you have a dismissal with prejudice because you can't bring it again?
It does at least with respect for this type of case. And I'll say, Your Honor, that there are separate chains of cases that relate to contract law or to other statutes. But Alliance One dealt with the application of 4.85.250.
To a dismissal without prejudice.
It was in that case without prejudice, but the public policy analysis said you basically have to have a determination on the merits with a hearing on the merits. That's in the public policy language of Alliance One. And what we have here is a district court saying, this isn't the type of order, this wasn't intended to be the type of order to invoke the statute.
Was there an appeal of the district court's determination to dismiss with prejudice?
There was no cross appeal on that issue, Your Honor. On the other hand, I don't believe it's procedurally necessary, because what the Superior Court does is it takes the record before the district court and modifies it as necessary to effectuate what it can infer.
Did it change the ruling of the district court?
I believe it did, Your Honor. I believe it took the reasonable inference from the district court's second order.
Did it change the ruling to a dismissal without prejudice?
It did not enter an order specifically changing the ruling without prejudice.
So regardless of, I mean, even whether the court made a finding on the merits or not, is not really relevant at this point. The only issue is, was it dismissed with prejudice? And it was, and it was not appealed. So that issue is done, is it not?
I disagree, Your Honor, that that's the only issue. And the reason being specifically under Alliance 1, it requires a hearing on the merits, which there is no evidence before this court that there is, to apply this statute. Furthermore, the Superior Court, this court can go back and look at the evidence before the district court and look at what the district court intended to do, and this court can modify it under Rawls 9.1.
And your authority for why intent makes a difference is exactly what?
My authority for why intent makes a difference is exactly Rawls 9.1e, which specifically says the Superior Court, in reviewing it, can take the factual findings that are reasonably inferred from the district court orders below it. And the district court orders below include a specifically written statement.
Well, okay, I understand you're trying to make it into a 9.1, but my question was what law says that the entering court's intent is important in deciding whether something is a judgment on the merits?
We have nothing other than Rawls 9.1e, which has not been interpreted. But 9.1
we really don't have anything. I mean, really, a judgment, it's hard for me to imagine what the state of the law would be if every judgment on the merits were subject to question, because we needed to go back into the record of the trial court and find out whether the trial court really intended to do that. I mean, unless there's a typo or something.
But that's what Rawls 9.1e says, Your Honor. So every judgment is not a district court judgment to the Superior Court, where the Superior Court is specifically empowered to do exactly that and did that, and this court should sustain it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. At some point, I don't really know where to start here. I mean, we're discussing the subjective intent of orders, and I would agree with Your Honor, Judge Becker, on that point. I don't think there's any authority that says we need to go inquiring into what a subjective intent was so that we can then unwind a judgment and figure out what was really intended below the scenes. I guess I just don't follow that. To the extent that Elliott Bay's arguing about the Rawls 9.1 issue, yes, that is what governs appellate review in these cases. That's true. But I think that might be a little aside from the point that the Superior Court in this case, acting in an appellate capacity, entered or purported to enter or tried to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law, which when the commissioner granted discretionary review in this case said, of course, that's not proper. That's not what happens on appeal. We don't enter findings here. So, again, to the extent I even understand Elliott Bay's argument, I think there's some sort of retroactive inquiry they're trying to get into to say, well, if we looked at some other factors, maybe fees wouldn't have been appropriate. I guess I just don't really even follow that line of argument. The fact is RCW 484-250 is pretty straightforward, and Alliance 1 v. Lewis supports my client's position. Alliance 1 v. Lewis involved a dismissal without prejudice. It's at a three-part test, which is, in fact, more like a two-part syllogism, really, which just required that there be a case filed under $10,000, that there be an entry of judgment, and therefore that's what deems someone a prevailing party. So that's all that's at issue here. So
did the motion for dismissal inform the court at the time why it was being dismissed?
Did Elliott
the response?
Yeah, the response did, Your Honor, because my client, Karen Documos, she was sued over this $482 debt, which she never owed. And that was admitted, and that's on clerk's papers 84 of the record, that my client did not and never owed money. That was not something that Elliott Bay figured out after filing a legitimate case and doing discovery and saying, oh, maybe we should back off from this. they knew the whole time that she did not owe money, and it was either oversight or, you know, whatever the reason was. That's one of the reasons we have a pretty straightforward statute, 484-250.
Well, a transcript would have allowed us to know whether the court discussed the contents of those moving and responding papers and was motivated by the fact that the debt didn't exist in making the change to a dismissal with prejudice. That's why I asked.
Oh, I understand, Your Honor. Well, as I mentioned in my reply brief, the court's written order always controls over any oral ruling. So I agree that it would be, I guess, in some parts illustrative to understand the reasoning process behind how that did occur. I think that it is established law that, yes, a party has a right to a, quote, CR 41 dismissal, and that's true, but it's by motion, not by notice. It's a motion. So if a party brings a motion, then, of course, the discretion, which has been conferred on trial judges, is to dismiss with or without prejudice. And what is in the record is Elliott Bay's admission and the briefing below indicating why the case should be dismissed with prejudice, because it should never be brought again. It never should have been brought in the first place. Low on time. Any questions? Thank you, Your Honor, for your time.